Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan. And today we're going to do something a little special. My good friend, Mike Rufo, who had a long and distinguished career working with energy efficiency and modeling and resource planning and cost effectiveness evaluations, he gave it all up some years ago and became a musician. And he's really a musician and an activist. And he's going to tell his story here today, and he's going to play his brand new song, The Reckoning. So just really excited to have Mike on the podcast today. Hey, Mike, welcome to the podcast. It's so great to see you, man.
Likewise.
Where are you sitting? Are you at home in, is it Oakland or Berkeley?
Yeah,
where you live?
I'm at home in Oakland, Piedmont.
Oakland, Piedmont. And I've heard great things about your house from our mutual friend, Kari, and about your backyard jams.
Oh, right.
And here's this guy, Mike Rufo, who I've known for years in the DSM world. And then he's having those really cool backyard jams I got to get in on one of these days.
Yeah, yeah. We started running house concerts, I think around 2019. Just do a couple, two, three a year. Dropped off a little bit during the pandemic, but we always did them indoors. And then during the pandemic, about a year in, I had always thought about doing it in our backyard, but I couldn't quite get it straight in my mind, but I was kind of forced to make a go of it. And it worked out great doing it in the backyard. So now we do them indoor, outdoor, kind of just depends on the season and how people are feeling. And they're great. Yeah, I love doing house concerts.
And this just speaks to who you are, obviously. You know, you are a musician, but you're also somebody who loves people, bringing people together, right?
I do. That is true. I love bringing people together, and absolutely, yeah. And the house concerts are a great way to do that. So, and I just found being on the not so young side, it's a lot easier to get people to a house concert than to a loud bar.
That's right.
To listen to music.
How did this pivot take place, Mike? You know, I knew you. I think you're working for Altron at the time. We were all involved with demand side management, helping utilities, you know, usher in this whole new era of energy efficiency programs. And you were big in that space, right? And then I just sort of heard, you chucked it all away and you're a musician now. That's a big pivot.
I'm still doing a little bit of consulting. I semi-retired, I would say, in 2015. Prior to that, at the apex of it all, I was running a 100-person efficiency EM&B consulting practice inside Itron. I loved my career, and we'll hopefully get to talk about how that all started back in Hollywood in the 70s. And I loved it so much. I worked a lot, and I had a lot of energy, and I never thought I would burn out, but I probably burned out a little bit. You know, those 70, 80-hour weeks and all-nighters, which mostly what I did in my earlier career. But actually, I looked back after I semi-retired some years later, and while I still had access to the Itron timekeeping system, and looked at some of my timesheets, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, you paid your dues.
Just to finish the thread there. So then at that point, I always had this kind of artistic side, mostly around, originally it was just around writing and poetry. I didn't really play music. I can explain how that happened later. But by this time, I was playing music. I had started playing and singing to my babies when my kids were born. So that's when I first started singing. I'd always written stuff. The words always came. But learning to play music was a little bit later, and singing was even later. Really, it was when I had the babies. And I was like, well, you got to love them unconditionally, and you got to sing to them. That's what I tell new parents. Those are the only two things you really need to know. Just love the heck out of them when they're babies and sing to them. And other things will take care of itself. But then, so around 2012, I did my first album, recorded my first album called Streets of Plenty. And I was still working full time. And it was a bit stressful trying to record that album while I was working full time. I remember pulling off the side of the road on the way to going to the recording session and talking to Mike Messenger about some crisis. I loved working with Mike. When I did that first album in 2012, it was like the toddler's first taste of ice cream. So I was like, oh, whoa, that's yummy. That's really cool. Because I carried around some songs my whole life that I had written, one-off songs. I didn't really identify as a songwriter or anything like that. I just would write a song when I felt like it. But then when I got them produced with a really great producer, multi-instrumentalist, and heard them kind of come to life with full arrangements, and it blew my mind. So then the wheels started turning, like, oh, I want to do that more. So that's when I went through a period. I had always wanted to semi-retire at a certain point to do something else. I didn't know what that something else was going to be. But by this point, the voice was saying, hey, okay, you said we were going to, you know, cut back on the 80-hour weeks and do something artistic. Let's do the music thing. And I went back and forth on that for many years until really it was like these two parts of myself in conflict. And the creative part was calling BS on the worker part, saying, hey, you've kind of taken all the oxygen in the room for a long time here, and let's see what would happen if we put a little bit of water in the songwriting plant. And so it was hard, though. It was hard because I said I was kind of wanted to step away from all that, but my ego identity was very attached to, you know, that conflict between, hey, I just want to chill out, and the other part saying, hey, we like being, you know, important.
It wasn't, and I presume there was a financial reality as well. I mean, you're going from a good paying job to being a musician, which is, you know, tough road, right?
Yeah, big fish in a little pond to a molecule in an ocean of you know, musical talent, and yeah, financially, music is, it's brutal. You know, I've gotten to know a lot of musicians over these years, and I'm so impressed by them. They're so hardworking. They're so talented. And it's so dang tough to survive and pay the rent in that field. So I can to support them as well through the house concert.
Yeah, and maybe,
and, you know, I love hiring musicians, session musicians for shows and recordings.
And maybe you've had the best of both worlds here. You know, you had your profession, you know, your deeply analytical consulting career. And now you just flop over, and you know, you're not like the musician, you're not the starving artist that we know several of, don't we?
Yes. Well, that is, it's true. You know, it's a double-edged sword. You know, it's nice not to have to do it to pay the rent, but you can see how that dimension really also puts a lot of energy and wind behind people's sails. You know, in today's music world, it's so much, the artist has to do everything. You know, the artist has to do all this marketing and just has to wear so many hats and has to be active on social media, which I am not. I am, you know, on there, but come and go. And, you know, the model is you just got to be kind of relentlessly out there on social media. And there's people who are great at it. You know, they make great music. A group called the Rainbow Girls up here who have gotten more and more popular, and I think they really kind of blew up during the pandemic online, and they're just so great, you know, in front of the camera, and they're great musicians and songwriters. So, you know, that's great that they can do that. But for some of that part, I struggle with is anything around self-promotion. I think because I had to hustle as a consultant my whole career and write so many proposals saying, where are the best consultants ever, and this methodology is the, now I'm just like, oh, I don't want to self-promote at all.
How did this, let's go back and talk just for a few minutes about your upbringing and your career. You, I believe you grew up in California. Is that right?
Well, I landed in Hollywood, in the flats of Hollywood, in when I was 11, in the early 70s. And prior to that, I lived in Philadelphia and moved around a lot, had kind of a wild, non-traditional childhood. My mother was embracing the 60s and, not sticking with any fella. A couple dads
really?
Came and got separated from, and lived in a commune in fourth grade in Philadelphia, and wow. Went to a different elementary school for second, third, fourth, and fifth and sixth grades. So it was a wild time. Moved across the country like three times when I was 12, wow. In the back of a Ryder truck with cats and my sister. So then we landed in LA and Hollywood for middle school and high school. And that was really good for me. Wasn't great for my sister, but, you know, different that's a whole nother wild thing of how our lives go and different timings and experiences, even within the same family. But LA was good for me. And I had this experience when we first moved there. So we were living there about 3 weeks, and we was down by Melrose and Vine. I always say the flats of Hollywood, because some people who aren't from the area think, oh, Hollywood, it's like Beverly Hills. No, it's very working class. And I look up the street one day, and there's the Hollywood sign in the Hollywood Hills. Well, I knew what that was, because everybody knows what the Hollywood sign is, but I'd never seen it before. Like, where'd that mountain come from? 12 years old. What the... I'm like, oh, that's what they mean by smog. So I heard people talk about smog. But when you're in it as a kid, it just seems like haze or fog. And I put one and one together. I said, oh, the air has been so dirty, I couldn't see that mountain. I didn't have the word environmentalism, none of that. I just knew in my kid head, it was that moment. I'm sure most kids have this at some point where you go, oh, the adults don't actually really know what they're doing. And then we had the twin oil crises, 73 and 78, and being in LA, which is so car dependent, it wasn't hard to imagine the whole thing just like grinding to a halt, and just didn't make sense to me. Why are we using all this oil that's a non-renewable resource, throwing it into the air where we can't breathe, sitting in traffic bumper to bumper in these vehicles that are used only 3% of the time? You know, none of it made sense to me. I was like, there's got to be a better way. And luckily, I stumbled onto an environmental studies class at LA Valley College. Shout out to our city colleges. They're so important. Last bastion for affordable higher education. And I took an environmental studies class, and I was like, bam, what's this? Oh, wow. I could do this. I'm going to do this. This is what I got to do. It was a revelation, you know, to know there's kind of this field of study. And then I went up to Sonoma State and studied with Rocky Roeder, who introduced me to Amory Lovin's work. And Rocky was just the most amazing mentor and environmental educator. Just had a big impact on me, and we're still pals to this day. Then I went to grad school and worked with a guy named Mike Brambley, who taught me the rigors of the scientific method. He had worked with S.S. Penner on his PhD, who was the editor for a while, the Energy Journal. So Mike kind of beat me up on like the scientific method and rigor.
Were you sort of honing in on electric utilities at that point then?
At that point, I had just been looking at everything. You know, we were just talking about kind of ecotopia and how we get to solar and wind. And this is in the early 80s. And I really wanted to do solar electricity at that point. You know, I wanted to do solar electrical generation work, but there just wasn't a lot of that happening. You know, it was all just pretty niche, remote stuff. It wasn't at scale. So when I went to grad school, my advisor, Mike Brambley, he was sitting on some data from these energy efficiency pilots down in San Diego, where they were weatherizing homes. And he had wanted to do this test and control group thing and use this thing called the Princeton scorekeeping method to analyze the savings. And so that was my master's thesis, was the Princeton scorekeeping method. And I got a hold of Mimi Goldberg's PhD thesis in stats, in which she kind of described how all the stats would work for the Princeton scorekeeping method. And I applied that to these pilot programs down in San Diego. And I also did like one of the first like aggregate prism analyses for natural gas consumption in St. Louis, where I was studying for like 20 years. Anyway, so yeah, that's how I kind of landed into doing program evaluation work.
Right. And then at Itron, wasn't that the era where there were all these different screens for cost effectiveness of programs? And you had the...
Yeah, well, it all started at Zenergy, X Energy. Yeah. That was my first company that I worked for. I worked 15 years at Zenergy, which is now DNV. So Zenergy was the demand side kind of core for what the DNV consultancy is today. It got acquired a few times, but Zenergy back in those days was one of the first consultancies in demand side consulting and implementation. They also did implementation work. Yeah, so we, in the early, when I first got hired, I was working on the first energy efficiency potential studies in California for SCE and SDG&E and SMUD and PG&E. We had a kind of a clean sweep there. We had a good tool. We had one of the first models to do energy efficiency potential studies, the DSM Assist model, which Kelly Warner and Harvey Michaels and Rich Barnes and myself had all had a hand in. So yeah, that was really cool. Then did like some of the first measure cost studies. I think the first measure life study I worked on. So it was all very, very interesting and exciting work. Had some great clients, like Mike Bessinger was one of my first clients. And he was like, well, we got to factor in what the impacts of all these evaluations are into our forecast of how energy efficiency is going to reduce load. And we can, you know, factor that into reducing the power plants that get purchased. And I was like, yeah, that's why we're doing this, right? But yeah. Then I kind of learned about all the complexities of like how you close that feedback loop between what we're accomplishing and then having that impact of avoiding these power plants from actually getting constructed.
Yeah, we were all in that space. We were all in that space, the different roles in that space, weren't we? You
know, yes.
Evaluating programs and implementing programs. And yeah, it was an exciting time. The utility, seems like the utilities were really turning. You know, that was like the classic tanker. You know, it's hard to make a turn, but at that point, the utilities were really turning to that demand side. And that what it ushered into the least cost utility planning and the integrated resource planning. And
that's right.
And now they're all putting out their integrated resource plans every 2 years or whatever the frequency is.
Yeah, now we've brought carbon management into that, which is really radical. I mean, this is a radical shift going from just integrated resource planning around reliability and cost to eliminating carbon. So integrated decarbonization and resource planning is a very
amazing. I saw this amazing documentary over the weekend that just showed, you know, so you got Greta Thunberg on one hand, you know, this young girl, and then you probably saw the news of these seniors in Switzerland that are, you know, championing human rights and going after climate issues, you know, based on human rights. So your career, you really were able to, you've made a contribution all along after the kids seeing the smog in LA, knowing this is what the environmental path is, what you wanted to be on. You were on that path. And then, like you said, you got pretty burnt out doing the consulting thing. And then this music, you produced an album, you kind of got the bug. And then at some point you must've decided, okay, what was the point where you just decided, I'm going to make the transition now. Here I go. Here goes Mike Ruffo. Watch.
Well, like I said, that was actually went on for a couple of years. Literally it got down to me on my way to work, looking at myself in the bathroom mirror and the two parts kind of having at each other. And the one saying, come on, you said we're going to do it. And the other one being like, well, we got to get through the kids through college. We got to make this transition. We got to just win one more job. We got to train some more people. We got to manage the transition. And the other one saying, I'm not buying it. This is just a stall tactic. And then finally, I just had to do it. You know, I just had to take the plunge.
And your family supported you.
My wife has been so supportive. Oh my God. I'm so fortunate. Like she never batted an eye about it. And I'm really grateful. So she's been very, very, very supportive in, you know, just kind of wanting me to pursue, you know, what makes me happy. Yeah. I could have done a better job. I think she also thought that she might be getting more of a, get a little bit better domesticity out of me. I don't know how to put it.
more dishes, I think.
I love the dishes. I love meditating and I love doing dishes. I'm just not the best at the cooking thing. And maybe my cleaning tolerance and hers are maybe not completely synced, but I keep trying, you know, but I think maybe I could have done a little bit better on that front, but I'm still working on it, and we're still together, and we've been, you know, through a lot.
Well, I give her a lot of credit, of course. And then it seems as though I've listened to some of your music, beautiful folky music, a lot of it, and a lot of it about love. And but it seems as though recently, and certainly the song you're going to play for us today, this is all about melding your environmental passions with your musical passions, right? You're now a messenger. You know, it's sort of, I think in your bio somewhere, it's, you know, you're also an activist. You're a singer, songwriter, guitarist and now an activist, right? You're using your music to be active, right?
Yeah. I would, and that's a continuing evolution. Like one of the things that I liked doing when I semi-retired with music was going out and supporting activists, you know, in the field, you know, when they were going out to Lawrence Livermore with Daniel Ellsberg. And, you know, I wrote a little twist on Down by the Riverside to inspired by his words. You know, there was an annual protest that goes on every year out at Lawrence Livermore National Lab against nuclear weapons, which was also one of my great passions when I was young, was trying to denuclearize the world. So, you know, going there and while people are, you know, getting arrested, playing them songs, you know, to be in solidarity and inspire them as they're doing their nonviolent civil disobedience at the gates of Lawrence Livermore Lab. And I've also did that with a peace group, a women-led peace group, Code Pink. Did that a few times where I went out and we went out to the desert in Nevada where the drone Air Force bases are and did some nonviolent peace work there. Played music for them. But I've also kind of come around to, you know, I've done some activism in my songs, not a ton. And when I found, I'm now on the board of a new startup nonprofit called Music Declares Emergency, as in climate emergency. And we're the U.S. flavor. We're a U.S. 501(c). There's country chapters in 16 countries. It was founded in the UK in 2019. And the moniker of the organization is No Music on a Dead Planet, which right, I wore three t-shirts for you, Ted. One is my Helsinki album cover.
Yeah.
Two is the No Music on a Dead Planet. And I'll save the other one for the finale. But yeah, this Music Declares Emergency organization, a pal came to me and said, oh, Mike, I think this would be a good fit for you with your interest in activism and your energy climate policy experience and your love of music. And it was. So Music Declares Emergency is like the center of the Venn diagram for me with activism, music, yeah, and energy climate policy. And they wanted me to be kind of the energy climate policy person on the board. And with Music Declares Emergency, what we're working on is working with artists to use the power of music to mobilize hundreds, thousands of climate policy activists, climate voters and climate policy activists. So last year, I met with a couple potential partners and found two great partners for us. One is called Climate Change Makers, and they train citizen climate activists at the local and state level. And then another is called Environmental Voter Project, and they do get out the vote for pro-environment, low-propensity voters. And so we also have another partner called Headcount, which does voter registration. So the idea is to work with artists who care about climate, and you know they're already these are artists who have already you know shown that they're saying they think there's a climate emergency. We have a declaration about the climate emergency and using your voice about it that thousands of artists have signed. Billie Eilish has signed it. Major Lazer, 1975. A lot of artists have signed this declaration. Now what we're doing is kind of circling back with the artists and trying to collaborate, because it's one thing to sign a declaration, but what we want to do is have a program where we have calls to action with these household name artists, and they can drive their climate caring fans to these, yep, organizations who are set up to, you know, put them to good use basically, and kind of try to create a virtuous circle there. So it's kind of my first it's a foray into program implementation, if you will. And I'm working on a theory of change for why this makes sense. Yeah. And how artists can address some of the barriers to action that politicians and scientists can't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, talk about this. The new song is The Reckoning, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. It's called The Reckoning.
Tell us about that and tee it up for us.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I've written 50 songs or more and really only two about the environment. or, you know, things related to my field. The first one I never published, and I haven't quite finished it. It was when I was 18 years old and I was working in a factory. And it was kind of prophetic, actually, because it was talking about the same crisis that we're in. I'd never published that one. And then I was messing around with my guitar, and I like to use a partial capo, which is, we don't need to get into the technicalities. For those who know what a capo is, a partial capo is a smaller version that only applies to a few strings. And the thing I like about the partial capo is it gives you an open tuning. And also, like, different guitars and different tunings will lead to different songs. Just something about the instrument itself can kind of like drive a song. You'll hear songwriters talking about that. And so I kind of was just getting into this kind of percussive thing that was happening because I was using this gear arrangement, as you can see there, the part of the cape. I know we're not on camera, but for Ted.
Very good. Yeah.
So, I was just doing that and kind of heard this kind of heartbeat percussive sound and didn't know what it was, what it was meant to be, but it started to become kind of like a call to me of something. And so then it just, lyrics started flowing out and about the climate situation. And as it turned out, you know, I wasn't really trying to do anything. You know, people talk about different approaches to songwriting. I tend to be on the pretty organic side, just whatever emotion or feeling is kind of, if I slow down enough to feel and let my unconscious mind kind of be allowed to integrate whatever's going on, then something might flow out. I was a little bit stuck on the on one part of it, and then I brought it to my producer, and been fortunate to work with a great producer who's an amazing multi-instrumentalist, Gowan Matthews. I've worked with him on all my albums in some capacity. So he gave me a little tweak on one thing, and I was like, oh, okay, there we go. We got it. So I brought in my friend Sarah Larkin, who sings with a band called The Real Sarah. She's just an amazing singer. Oh, her lead singing and songwriting is amazing, and she's tremendous in the studio and with harmony. She can just come up with harmonies really fast. And so a couple of times now I've just thrown her into the studio and she's not even had that much time to prepare. Like, here's the songs, and then she does something great. And then I met a drummer, a well-known top drummer in acoustic music in Americana, named Brady Blade. I met him last year, and I asked him if he would play on the album. And he toured last year with the Indigo Girls, and has played with Emmylou Harris and Steve Earle and Dave Matthews Band. And he just knocked it out of the park on this track. I just, the drumming that he put on the track, I think this was exactly just nice. Gave it that next nice. Urgency and intensity. So. Yeah, but the song itself too, I didn't want to, as it turned out, you know, I didn't want to write something preachy or with an answer. It was, it's more of a question, and it's really just about all of us as human beings reckoning with what's going on with the earth, because we don't really know that. I mean, we know a lot. I shouldn't say, we know a darn lot, but it's still the earth, the climate is so complex, and people don't realize that all of human, everything that we associate with our human culture really has evolved in this very narrow window of nice climate. And that's not the historic norm for Earth. Earth has been through all kinds of different, Earth has been a snowball. Earth has been so hot, and we need our Earth to stay chill in the space that it's been in. So it's really meant to be a conversation, between humanity and Earth, but it's really humanity talking. Earth doesn't really respond in the song. It's just humanity wondering what the heck it's, you know, and you know, hopefully kind of coming to, you know, maybe we don't have all the answers, but we're trying and we're listening.
Play it for us, man.
All right. Just a part.
I thought the whole thing, whole thing, whole
you
thing.
You want the whole thing?
Yeah, I want the whole thing. After.
Something tells me now, my friend, you might not be the same again. Taking all your gifts and then didn't even notice when you cried while our big boat stole and lied. You don't owe me anything, haven't had much good to bring to the creatures of your land. Why should you lend your hand while I cry out for one more chance? Trying to find what you need. Yes, I see where you bleed. If I listen, will you tell me how to make you well? How to make you well? You had it all so dialed in. I thought you were a game to win. Hubris is my cardinal sin. Unbridled greed, it's evil twin. And I know that there is nowhere else to go. Trying to find what you need. Yes, I see where you bleed. If I listen, will you tell me how to make you well? How to make you well? You've got a fever, your temperature's high. Your eyes are wet, your seas are on the rise. You look so restless, waking from your sleep. I'm trying to heal you, but my problems run so deep. So if I swear to change tonight, if I swear to make it right, if I dare to see the light, if I work with all my might, oh, tell me, do I have a chance? Trying to find what you need. Yes, I see where you bleed. If I listen, will you tell me how to make you well? How to make you well.
All right. How great, Mike. This has been a fantastic podcast. I'm just sitting here with a big grin on my face. It's been so great to connect. I give you such great credit for this pivot. It's a brave, bold, indicative of what all of us need to be looking at. How do we align? How do we get the best life possible? And you're on that path. So, Mike, is there anything that you're just dying to say before we sign off? Did we miss
my third T-shirt? Which says,
okay, yeah, no podcast guest has shown me a single T-shirt, much less three. So here we go.
Third one.
What do we got?
This is my local band name, No Exit.
Uh huh.
Which is after the Jean-Paul Sartre play No Exit of existential fame, which is kind of considered. You know, a lot of existentialism, when you look it up, it's characterized so depressingly, you know, and so darkly. But I'm trying to focus on ecstatic existentialism. And this was my climate buddy, the Edward Munch's The Scream. But yeah, the thing about No Exit, the way I look at it is, what I mean by that is, this is our planet. You know, they're not going to follow, you know, Elon Musk. I got nothing against studying the cosmos. That's great. But, you know, there's no exit onto some other planet here. And that's not where the resources need to be going. You know, we have this one planet. We got to protect it from nuclear annihilation, from climatic change. And, you know, we have all the knowledge and the resources that we need to create our own little ecotopia here on Earth. It's within our reach. So
Mike, thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for your time today. Thanks for playing us a song. And
well, Ted, let me thank you too. You have been an inspiration throughout my career, and just love the way I listened to all three episodes about your travels with your daughter, and that just warmed my heart. It was a great trip down memory lane for the things I knew. And then I learned so many different things that I didn't know about you and your adventures, and the way you bring people together across the globe has been so powerful and so important. Yeah. So thank you so much. And your equanimity, the way you, your podcast and just, your vibe, if I can use that term, that technical term, appreciate you so much.
Works for me. All right. Thanks, Mike. Great stuff. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.